I'm going to talk tonight about the learner's progress. What is a learner? It's someone who isn't yet enlightened, but is making steps in that direction. The person out on the street who has no interest in meditation and isn't studying in any way, things of that kind, isn't a learner because he or she hasn't yet started. Those who have started, they developed an interest of some kind and are developing as best they can along a particular path. Such people are learning. They are learners and hopefully they're making progress. That progress continues right up until enlightenment itself. And only the enlightened person then is not a learner in common with the man in the street, which should tell you an awful lot. In this way, there is no sudden development, there's no sudden change. You don't suddenly make a giant step forward. All progress is very, very gradual. Indeed, some find it imperceptible to start with. They work away, nothing seems much to be happening, and it's only the perspective of time that gives them a clue as to just how far they've come. After 6 months or a year or 18 months, it's possible to look back to how you felt before, how you lived before, and you find there have been very considerable changes. You don't get as steamed up about things in the wrong way. You find yourself generally happier. You understand yourself better than you did before. You get on better with your friends, neighbours, partners than you did before. But none of these things is perceptible as it's happening. The progress is indeed gradual. Let's try, if we can, and trace the course of development from the initial interest in a subject like meditation or philosophy or things of the inner person right up to the point of enlightenment. Obviously, the first thing that's necessary is a general interest. But how does that develop? What is it that turns somebody on to meditation? It can't just be the fact that they have heard of it, or that they have friends who do it. It can't be that they've read a book about it and have suddenly become fired. For why did they bother to read the book in the first place? You'll find, if you look back for yourselves, that there is a burning sense of dissatisfaction, which is the starting point. The feeling that there must be more to life than this. The feeling, perhaps, that life's futile, that there's no point in going on, and yet at the same time, there must be more. Or maybe it's some anguish, some immediate sorrow, the death of a loved one, perhaps. There's something, somewhere, which can be classified as suffering, which has turned the mind towards thoughts of, what should we call them, thoughts of a deeper nature, and the interest in things other than the norm, things other than the ordinary day-by-day living, that interest has grown stronger and stronger. Eventually, interest in a way such as this. The general interest leads to an actual introduction to the teaching. And with that, we can begin to outline a series of quite definite steps through which a person has to go if they're going to develop in the right way towards the cessation of suffering itself. Some of those steps are as follows. When someone comes across a way like this, they find that they are introduced, probably in a fairly easy fashion, to certain rules of conduct. And I don't specifically mean the Buddhist way, although it obviously is covered along with everything else, but any meditative way is founded upon, rests upon, certain rules of conduct. They're in this way called precepts, and there are five basic ones. which I hope you're all familiar, but just for the record, let's outline them. There's the rule of training, and notice that it is a rule of training. We're now talking about learning how to become free from suffering of all kinds. We have to train ourselves in that endeavor. So the first rule of training is to refrain from killing or harming. Fairly obvious. The second is to refrain from stealing, and in its more subtle aspects, to refrain from taking that which isn't actually given to us. And anyone who's lived in a community or lived in close quarters with others, in perhaps a rooming house where you share the fridge, that sort of thing, knows just how important that rule can be to good social relations. Then there's the rule of training to refrain from sexual misconduct. The rule of training to refrain from lying, or wrong speech of all kinds, lying, slander, gossip, tale-bearing, anything which will upset the smooth running of a group of people, anything which is divisive, not only of a group, but of yourself from the group. And lastly, of these five, but by no means least, to refrain from alcoholic drinks and mind-affecting drugs, for the very obvious and simple reason that we need all our faculties if we are to attend properly to what it is that we are doing. Those rules of training are one of the first things anyone coming into contact with the meditative way will come across. They will also be associated, if the thing is taught rightly, with two other terribly important concepts. Practices would be a better word. The practice of dana, that's giving, and the practice of metta, or loving kindness. Generosity is an incredibly important part of developing the way to enlightenment. Why? Very simply, it reduces selfishness. It reduces avarice. It makes people easier to live with. It makes them easier to live with themselves. Metta is the other side of that same coin. To develop warm and friendly feelings and for people other than those immediately close and dear to you. And notice how metta is practiced. It's not simply working on a feeling level, it's working on a thought level too. One takes time out to think of people's good points. Why should that be necessary? Why do not the good points stand out, obviously? I read in a book the other day that this country, indeed in common with all Western cultures, spends millions and millions of pounds on training the intellect and nothing on training love. Put that way, it's quite a shocking statement, and yet it turns out generally to be true. What is the intellect? The intellect is a divisive tool. It's an analytical tool. It's there to split things up into smaller pieces. I'm not denying its value. Clearly it's important in so many different areas. But if you only train the intellect and you don't train love, then what have you got? You've got a tremendous capacity to analyze, to separate, to criticize, and only an untrained, lucky capacity to love. Now, love can be trained just as much as hate can be trained. So, where we are so ready to think bad things about people, think negative things about people, bring into play then the intellect and the critical function, we are far less able, initially, to bring into play the positive side of thinking, to think good things about people, to remove the divisive stuff, to stop criticizing, but to see only the good points. Metta, in certain of its aspects, can be practiced then by thinking to find the good points that people have, and everybody has some. Even your worst enemy may show tremendous strength of will, determination, and great powers of concentration. Some might call it stubbornness, but let's put the right perspective on it. These are admirable qualities. Seeing that about someone, one might at least generate a grudging respect in place of the previous animosity. It is amazing how well it works if you pursue it properly. So what have we got? The newcomer to a way such as this will be introduced to 5 rules of training, to the concept and practice of generosity, to the concept and practice of metta, loving kindness, friendliness. Each one of those three is tremendously effective in restraining selfishness, in restraining self-interest and self-concern. In short, the very first task is to reduce the level of self-concern to manageable proportions. Of course, it moves on from there, doesn't it? If you just stop there, okay, life would get considerably more comfortable, but there may not be very much insight generated with the small amount of meditation being done at that time. It needs to move on to the next step, which is meditation in earnest, usually in a retreat setting. So a week, 2 weeks, a month, for some people a year or 6 years, all depends. Meditation becomes the cornerstone of their existence. On meditation retreats, we don't rest content with 5 precepts, but rather go on to 8. They're the normal 5, but now sexual misconduct becomes celibacy. And then we have a couple of extra ones. No eating at the wrong time. So we find then that people are limited to the meals that are actually provided. If you take the House of Inner Tranquility, for example, the meals are provided at certain times, and you aren't able, hopefully, to snack between times. At least we haven't found many apple cores under the windows recently. People think that we don't know, but when you pick up a case to help someone upstairs and your arm nearly comes out of its socket, you know there's something not quite right. So, no eating at the wrong time, one of the rules of training. And the other one is, of course, no entertainment, no transistor radios or pocket tellies, no self-adornment, no makeup, no jewellery, no perfumes, no aftershave. Even wedding rings come off for the duration of the retreat. Now why? What's so important about those things? No eating at the wrong time. I think you can see that it again puts another notch on the question of self-restraint. One's beginning to reduce one's concern with self, seen as the body. So also is that true with respect to adornment, jewellery, makeup, aftershave and the like? So is it true with respect to entertainment? Now I know it's possible to spend ages and ages in front of the mirror getting the hair just right, but that, as you can see, would be going against the spirit of the thing, if not the actual letter. Why? To reduce self-concern even further. Going on from there, moderation in food is taught as an actual practice in some meditation centers. Particularly is it so for someone who takes the thing up full time, as a monk or a nun might do, then they are expected to learn to be moderate in food to the extent that they should never overeat. Food is one of the greatest pleasures that man has. To restrain the craving for food is a very useful way of restraining craving generally. Food, in fact, is so central to people's lives that if you ask them how was the holiday, they'll immediately start talking about the food, as often as not. Food is centrally important, which is why it occupies a separate stage all by itself. But going on from there, there is then a definite attempt made to restrain the five physical senses, to restrain the sense of sight, to restrain the sense of ear, if you like, the sense of hearing, and the other senses too. The sense of sight is particularly important to us. We are very visual beings. We rely, in some cases, entirely upon vision. If you hear a sound out in the garden and you can't quite place what it is, the urge to go and have a look is enormous. Now, if you were restraining the sense of sight, you would not go and have a look. The craving to see can be very, very pronounced in some people. That restraint of the sense of sight then means keeping the eyes down, quite literally, and not letting the eyes roam around, picking up this or that chunk of information, looking at this, grasping at that. There is a tremendous greed for visual objects for many of us. Equally, there's a tremendous greed for audible objects, so much so that you can even create them. I know one person who was bothered by the sound of sirens, ambulance sirens, and who heard these in his meditation for day upon day upon day upon day. And he began to suspect that there couldn't be that many ambulances going up and down the road, and realized that he was manufacturing the sound. He was imagining it. So strong was the craving for hearing at that time. So restraint of the five physical senses becomes of critical importance in the setting of a meditation retreat. Why? If you think about it, we feel that we need a certain level of sensory stimulation, a certain kind of sensory environment, before we can be truly happy. People look at the pictures of Ethiopia on the television and find themselves completely unable to imagine how anyone could exist in a country like that. The level of poverty is so extreme. Look at what we all have in the West. Even the poorest of us seems to do pretty well, on the whole. A roof over our heads, food to eat, clothes to wear, heating, lighting, transport, so many different things. And we begin to believe that these things are necessary for our very existence. We must have a decent sound system. We must have a telly. We must have this, that, the other thing. And so our eyes, our ears, all our senses are tuned to picking up these pleasant sensory objects. The restraint of the senses becomes a very, very interesting teaching technique. Teaching not by people like Jackie and me, but teaching yourself, by yourself, to learn about yourself, to discover where it is your predilections lie, to discover how it is you spend most of your time hooked on sight or sound or whatever it might be. Restraint of the five senses then means, at the time on a meditation retreat, acting in a very controlled manner. It means not allowing the eyes or the ears to wander all over the universe, as it were, but rather keeping them pinned on the immediate environment, keeping them pinned on the job in hand. It reduces the selfish craving for stimulation even further. It reduces self-concern as well. for we no longer have quite the same expectations of pleasure and comfort if we are prepared to restrain the senses in this way. That develops quite naturally into being mindful of everything we do, mindful of walking about, mindful of opening doors, mindful of eating. How many of you have truly spent a mindful half an hour eating a meal, where you've tried to be aware of everything connected with eating, from the smell of the food to all of the movements involved in picking up the implements, the feelings of pressure and temperature as you pick up, say, a fork, the intention to move towards the food, the weight increase of the fork as it has food on it, the intention to bring the arm up to the mouth, the fork up to the mouth, the temperature of the food, the feeling of the food, the taste of the food, the chewing itself. If you ever get hooked on chewing, it's the most amazingly complicated experience. How on earth the tongue doesn't get chewed up into a million little pieces. It's a wonder. And yet, you can watch all this and learn enormously about how this body runs itself. You don't actually control eating. There's no way you could control all those tiny movements of tongue, teeth, lips, and throat. You try and do it and you see what happens. You'll bite your tongue for sure. It is quite okay as long as we don't interfere, but this is all part of mindfulness of eating. It'll take you a long time to eat a meal, but it's worth it because you learn so much from it. In everything you do then, mindfulness to what is going on can become a fascinating experience. It can be absolutely gripping. So much so that you completely forget yourself, and there is only that action, that sensory experience, that group of muscles doing whatever it is they do so well. And you suddenly see, at times, that you are truly redundant. The ego isn't necessary. This body runs itself pretty well, thanks. It doesn't need any interference. So, mindfulness to all actions, sitting, walking, standing, lying down, eating, going to the bathroom, all activities can be attended to in this way, with a further lessening in self-interest, in egocentric, selfish interest, with a loss then of self-concern, even though paradoxically you seem at first sight to be very much taken up with yourself. But actually it's in a very objective manner, isn't it? There is no egocentric concern at such a time. That has completely faded temporarily. Indeed, the only time it comes back is if things suddenly go horrendously wrong. In other words, you allow yourself to decide that you're not moving along fast enough, that the meditation isn't going anywhere, that you've spent these last 2 days working like stink and nothing's happened. It really isn't going fast enough at all. When that sort of comparison comes up, then the trouble starts, doesn't it? Despair sets in, dejection, self-hatred, or perhaps that burning desire to really put the screws on, really get the thing rolling. And so then you start to try. You really start to force the pace. No one yet has given up anyway. If you force the pace, what happens? The body gets tense, the mind gets tense, it gets extremely painful, you get agitated, hatred builds, the whole thing begins to look like an unutterable waste of time, and you wondered why on earth you ever started, and could you decently leave? Well, no, not really, but so how can you get through the rest of the week? Dejection sets in, maybe there's a few tears, maybe you wonder what on earth you're going to do with your life, and the whole thing looks pretty grim. Now this is hardly restraining oneself, and yet it's what happens for everybody, and so it becomes apparent that there is a further restraint needed to avoid that self-concern of dejection, or indeed, if you think it's going ever so well, elation. That one is less frequent, I must admit, but it does occur. You do see it actually, when it suddenly starts to go very well, people get a bit conceited, and then there's no holding them. They start arguing with you, they tell you where you're going wrong, and you think, because you know they're going to trip up sooner or later, and there's not much you can do about it. What's missing? What's missing there is restraint of the mind. There's no even-mindedness, there's no patience, there's no taking things as they come. There's, based on that initial comparison of not making enough progress, has come all kinds of imbalance. That imbalance has led to some pretty severe problems in the moment. And those problems are only solved by refusing to allow the mind to run riot. Run riot? To run riot by imagining how well or how badly things are going. If you examine that little complex of feelings and thoughts, you'll find that there is always locked in there somewhere an idea of permanence. This terrible state of affairs is going to go on and on and on forever unless I do something about it. And there's the key, unless I do something about it. Self-concern once again. Self-interest. Restrain that and you're okay. Because everything's transient, in fact, which we all know in our better moments. If you just sit there watching and include the dejection or the elation in the meditation, you note it for what it is, then it fades. It disappears like anything else. Completely transient. Whereas if you decide that you are going to master your universe no matter what, it's so painful. But the extreme case, and I've known quite a few people who've managed to do this, they decide that they really will get it together no matter what. And they set themselves to sit for perhaps 2 or 3 hours at a stretch. Going to force the mind into control, under control. And it gets painful, as you might expect. More painful, excruciatingly painful, but still they won't give in. They start to shake. The pain gets worse. Sweat breaks out. Occasionally they find that all feeling disappears, only to come back redoubled. In the end, they give up. They give up because they just cannot go on anymore. And when they give up, there's a wonderful peace that spreads through the mind and body. What's happened? What's happened? Egocentricity has been let go of. But only when someone admits they're beaten. Now, why go through all that? It's not really necessary. Take it easy. Recognize that you're beaten right from the start. And sit there and observe quietly what's going on. Try and include it all. That way you can restrain dejection and elation and do no particular damage to yourself in the process. You're still going to get dejected and elated. That's part and parcel of the process. But there's no need to act upon them. If you include them, notice them as part of the meditation, then you'll be okay. If you do that properly, then the mind stays more or less balanced, and you begin to see that things like elation and dejection are indeed transient. They come and go, they're conditioned, they arise dependent upon conditions, just like anything else. So you come directly to a meditation on rise and fall, if you like, on the arising and passing away of phenomena. Now, okay, that's what you've been doing all along. But was it really? Often no. because you're trying to establish some kind of permanently blissful state or get rid of some annoying obstacle to the practice. You've been fighting it most of the time up until this point. But once you've got the restraint of dejection and elation more or less handled, then you really are in a position to sit there quietly and observe the coming and going of all the different phenomena, mental and material. Only then, when you are able to handle dejection, when you are able to handle elation, is the mind really clear enough, stable enough, if you like, to see what's going on. Now, what does that imply? It really implies again that there's less self-interest, less self-concern. Self-concern is diminishing all the time on this graduated course of progress. So the learner's progress is one which, taking an overview of it, can be seen as a gradual lessening in selfishness, or better, self-concern. Carlos Castaneda has a lovely term for it, a lessening of the sense of self-importance. So the further you go along the path, the less self-important you believe yourself to be. And, as a direct corollary, the happier you become. Self-importance is inversely proportional to happiness, as anyone can see for themselves through the meditation. So having gained a balance, having managed to restrain dejection and elation, we can then overcome the hindrances to meditation, those five which you're all so familiar with: sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, worry and flurry, or if you prefer, agitation, and skeptical doubt. Those five hindrances can be overcome by reasoned attention, by right attention, by wise attention, by attention which recognizes the objective of the meditation, which is to see the truth of things as they are, to see that whether or not things are transient, unsatisfactory, and anatta, non-self, not owned by me, and not me myself, not controlled by me, not any part of me. In short, a further lessening of self-concern. That's the way it goes, and it's that reasoned attention which then forms the mainstay of the meditation right through all the paths to enlightenment itself. But there is one vital component over and above this as well, and that is earnestness of endeavor. It's said that even the person who has all of these admirable qualities, is able to meditate, he can suppress the hindrances, can see things rising and passing away quite clearly, even such a person who has absolutely no doubt about the teaching, no doubt about the teachers, no doubt about the existence of enlightenment, even such a person who has trained himself or herself in all of those activities and actions which are loved by enlightened people. That really means they have the precepts off to a fine art. Not just the word, but the spirit of the thing entering into everything they do. Even such people, if they rest content with the stage they have reached and make no further effort, they will find, if they make no further effort to get seclusion by day and meditation by night, as such a person dwells remiss, not making any effort, he will experience no delight at all in the meditative way. Now, what does that mean? if there is no delight in your life, you'll find there is no zest. Everybody knows that to be true in one way. If a job becomes very boring, then you can hardly get yourself out of bed in the morning. Why? There's no zest. But if a job is vital, or you've just met someone at work who is vital, then there is zest, and you're out of bed bright and alert, and nothing is too much trouble. So if there's no delight, and for the person who doesn't earnestly endeavor in the meditation, there is indeed no delight, then there's no zest. Without zest, the body does not become calm. And where there's no calm, then one dwells in discomfort. The body is painful. One's circumstances are uncomfortable. One finds all kinds of upsets, internally and externally. So if you're living in discomfort the whole time, then the mind cannot become tranquil. And in the mind which is not tranquil, it is impossible that the teaching should show clearly, that the facts of life and living should show clearly. That's even for someone who is able from time to time to suppress the hindrances, who is doing all the right things otherwise. Conversely, someone who does make the effort, who meditates regularly on a daily basis, someone who tries their utmost to get periods of seclusion every day and every evening if they can, for such a person, you find that delight springs up in them. It really does. Those of you who had the, I think all of you would agree, pleasant experience of being on that group course where you're doing 8 solid hours meditation a day, nearly all of you found that delight arose in you because of that level of endeavor. Yeah? When that delight arises, then zest follows right behind. And when there's zest or piti, pleasurable interest, when that's there, then the body becomes very calm. All the aches and pains disappear. Comfort arises. There's no more tensions. There are no more difficulties in sitting. It becomes comfortable and easy. And under those circumstances, the mind becomes very tranquil. The mind and the body become tranquil. And with that tranquility, concentration arises. When concentration arises, you can see into your own nature very much more clearly. The teaching becomes clear to you by virtue of that concentration. You develop insight, seeing inward, based on that calm and that clarity. Now, earnestness is not simply applying a set of rules by the book. It's always intelligent and reasoned application. Unless you use wise attention, attention then which is aware of the objectives of the practice, then you're going to trip yourself up in one way or another. But with wise attention and the right sort of effort, you can be unstoppable in the meditation. But it's not you in the egocentric sense. It's the meditation becomes an unstoppable force in your life. And you progress at the fastest possible rate. But it does need that commitment. Wise attention is the key, commitment is the means. Let's sum it up. The learner's progress from initial interest in meditation right the way up to enlightenment is gradual. There's no sudden leaps or plunges from the shallows to the depths. It's a gradual deepening of insight, of understanding, of calmness, of happiness. It's brought about by earnestness of endeavor and wise attention. Those are the two keys to freedom. The path is one of continually lessening self-concern, continually lessening self-interest. And the tools you use are various, from precepts, giving, metta, and restraint of just about all kinds. Restraint of what? Restraint of selfish concern. With that, you can come completely to the end of suffering. You can come to the end of the path. Indeed, that is the only way to get to the end of the path. And once you get to the end of that path, there is enlightenment, and you can throw away your L plates. You're no longer a learner. Only the Arahant has completely eradicated all the hindrances. Only the enlightened person has no more hindrances to worry about. Everybody else up until that point is still working on getting rid of them. Such people who are working to get rid of them are learners. Right from the beginning to the end.